Senator Kevin Cramer, welcome back. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. I'm glad to be back. And by back, I mean I actually got home late last night on the plane, and of course missed the president's speech while I was flying. But I haven't even watched a clip of it yet, if you can believe Scott. But anyway, I am home, so that means I'm not in the cloakroom and can't hand the phone over to John Kennedy or Lindsey Graham or Ted Cruz. So it's only me today, Scott.
Oh my gosh!
When you think about privileges, Scotty, that to me that's still one of the great ones. Is that you get to be hang out with these guys that you used to watch on TV. And then when you get them trapped in the corner, you hand them the phone and say, "Hey, take this call for me."
Well, I there was a clip from last week with Lindsey Graham that I want to spend a little time talking about it, because I think it was in some ways a compliment of the level of fight that Donald Trump brings, but at the same time saying, there are consequences to that level of fight. I got to just unpack it a little bit with you. We'll save that because we've got calls already waiting to go and a few topics that have come in before the show even, so I want to just get to as many as we can today for Senator Kevin Cramer. And Eddie in Williston, you're first up here on What's on Your Mind. And then we'll go to Horace next. Williston, go ahead. You're up.
Yeah, this is Eddie. I'd like to ask the Senator, why is the United States giving foreign aid to countries like China?
Well, thanks, Eddie. First of all, the United States doesn't give, quote, foreign aid to China. Now, we probably participate in some things with China. We're trying to eliminate all kinds of foreign aid to places that aren't our friends, but there are places where we need to have some foreign aid because it's a matter of part of sort of what we call soft power, soft diplomacy, and so it's sort of a risk-benefit analysis. With regard to China, one of the questions, Scott, that I've asked a lot of people lately in front of me, especially on the Senate Armed Services Committee, and Eddie, I'm going to use this as a moment to just talk a little bit about specifically about China. You realize that the United Nations considers China a, quote, developing nation. So it gets to Eddie's point about foreign aid. What is it about a developing age, developing country versus a developed country? Well, there's a category in between those two called a country in transition, and it has to do with certain economic factors like unemployment and gross state product and all of these things. Well, the bottom line is gross domestic product. The bottom line is China is eating our lunch in very, very many categories, including economically in certain categories. And while they still have a very large unemployment rate, a lot of people in poverty, probably the bigger factor, I don't think we should be treating them, we being the United States or the United Nations or any other global organizations, as a, quote, developing nation. In other words, getting some of the assistance that Eddie might be referring to or that other countries provide to China. One thing I think we can be sure of is in the last 2 years, Donald Trump has taught us that China is not our ally. They may be a reasonable trading partner from time to time. There's 1.5 billion people there that buy things that we make and eat things that we grow. But by and large, they take that money as a country, they take money that they get and they use it against the world and not just the United States. So that growing awareness that China is not a good actor, that they do steal technology, they do steal secrets, they do spy on us, and they are building out a military that at a much, much faster rate than ours is being built. And we should no longer treat them, in my view, as a developing nation. And so that means not getting foreign aid or assistance. Now, we certainly, if there's a tragedy of some sort that affects millions of people in any country, friend or foe, the United States often leads in the generosity of that for the people of a country. But therein lies the other challenge, is that there are people in countries that aren't the government, and particularly in communist regimes and dictatorial regimes like China. And so sometimes it's hard to sort out the people from the leadership. Iran's another good example of that, where they have wonderful, beautiful people that would love to be free. But you might notice that just this week I joined onto a bill with Marsha Blackburn. I think it's called the Confucius Center Act, trying to, and another one, by the way, relating to sister cities. With China, trying to eliminate or at least put some restrictions on cities in the United States and Confucius centers in the United States, because China has used these relationships and these friendships and these diplomatic channels to spy on us and steal secrets, all over the place, from our universities and our innovators and our government. And so we're finally getting some traction on reining a lot of those activities in.
Appreciate the call, Eddie. And, some very good insights in there. And in the foe we have in China that is not recognized as a foe, the low-hanging fruit to me there said the idea that China is a developing nation gives you an idea just how stupid the UN is. Does the United States have any power over changing that?
Yeah, I suppose we do, like any member of the United Nations, but the reason I keep asking the question out loud in these hearings of generals and former generals and whatnot is because we need to have this discussion. Do we continue to treat the largest economy in the world next to ours, growing at a very rapid pace, hostile to everything we stand for and believe, do we continue to treat them like, you know, a third world nation, and that's not what developing necessarily means, but it's a similar treatment, or do we treat them like the near peer adversary and great power conflict enemy that they are, rather than some sort of a charity case? And I think the answer is pretty clear. They are a foe to not to be taken lightly. And you are seeing a change, obviously, in attitudes around the world. In fact, I'd say in other places. I've spent time with the defense minister in Australia, Australia's defense minister, on this topic, as well as others in the Indo-Pacific. Just last week, or just earlier this week, we had both a classified briefing and then a hearing with the commander of the Indo-Pacific Command, which, you know, is responsible for that part of the world, and I won't go into a lot of it because some of it's classified, but there's no question there's a growing awareness, and we need our friends on the left to get a better understanding of that, and I believe that they are.
Yeah, the founding fathers would be spinning in their graves knowing how we treat China right now, given the level of threat they pose to the United States in so many provable black and white ways. It's unbelievable. Eddie, thanks for raising the point. I'll go to a texter because we have short time for an answer here. Is it true black farmers, other minority farmers, are getting billions of dollars in reparations?
Great. That's getting right to the point, isn't it? Yes, there's a part of the this most recent monstrosity COVID relief supposed bill, it's a $4 billion line, part of the $1.9 trillion, specifically for farmers who are socially disadvantaged. Now, I use that term, it's sort of like developing and developed, socially disadvantaged. And they define socially disadvantaged as black, brown, other minority groups, not women. But the $4 billion is just a marker because it also says, or as much as is necessary. And what it does is it pays any socially disadvantaged farmer who has a loan with the USDA, pays them 120% of that loan. Goes to the farmer. And they can pay off the bank or not.
How do you pay off a loan with 120% of the loan? Sounds like you're getting a gift plus you're paying off the loan. More on this when we come back with Senator Cramer. Don't go away. Back with Senator Kevin Cramer, the Talk Radio Town Hall. So the $4 billion, which you say has a little sticky note next to it that says, really, spend $40 billion if you want to, as long as it goes to socially disadvantaged farmers, and we're going to pay off 120% of their loans, meaning their loans paid off and we give them money? We write a check from the government or what?
So that's why people call it reparations. Because if it was, you know, if his loan, you know, payment, it'd be however much you owed. You know, if it's just like, say, a student loan debt or something up to and things like that. Anyway, there's a lot to it, and some of the gymnastics that were gone through in the House to lower it from 120 to 100 and, you know, then get it ramped back up in some different language in the Senate by Schumer. You have to get sort of creative with the parliamentarian. All these things I'll spare you, these archaic Senate rules. But, yeah, that's why it's reparations and not simply, loan forgiveness or something like that. It's actual, a real reparation. And the sticky note you point to, and that's common in a lot of mandatory spending. That's what makes it mandatory. It's what makes it, quote, an entitlement, is that while it's given a number which is based on a score by the Congressional Budget Office and to, you know, estimation, it's not confined to that number because it's or as much as is necessary from the Treasury to fulfill all the need or however the language goes.
I posted something on Facebook after this was agreed to by the House and everything's final. I said, I think this, number one, could be the last significant piece of legislation from the Biden administration because it's so egregious, it's so stupid that I think that, that there's a potential here. They're going to get nothing else done other than defend this monstrosity. Am I dreaming?
No, it's a great point, Scott, and it's a good conversation to have, especially with your audience who's so savvy. So they have two more opportunities still this fiscal year, because this was based on budget reconciliation, based on a budget resolution, not, again, not to bore you with the archaic talk, but a budget resolution for the current fiscal year. They still can do two budget resolutions, one for revenue and one for spending, for next year's budget. And they intend to do that. And what that does is that allows them to do another completely partisan bill. The problem with that is, to your point, this monstrosity is such an overreach. Now, I'll tell you this little story. Just yesterday, a New York Times reporter asked me, aren't you guys running a terrible risk by opposing this thing and playing, aren't you playing right into Chuck Schumer's hands because of this messaging strategy to oppose this very popular bill? And I said, no, and this is why. It's not a strategy. It's just telling the truth, and it's letting people know what they didn't know before, because there were no hearings in the House. There were no hearings in the Senate. There was no bipartisan support. There was bipartisan opposition to the bill, but no bipartisan support. And now, once the $1.9 trillion is spent and the facts start rolling out, when people start finding out, gee, not only did I get a check for $1,400, I'm getting a bill for $6,000. That's going to cost every person in America, man, woman, and child, $6,000 for this monstrosity.
And by the way,
I think a $1,400 check.
I've had people jump up and down about, when's that next pet check coming? When's the check coming? I want to go to Hawaii. I want to plan a vacation. I want to pay. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, people, have we gotten to the point now where we think that we need a check from the government that supposedly is for COVID relief, that, you know, and I know there's people out there in need. I wish we would have targeted it for them and given them more than $1,400, for crying out loud.
Right.
Somebody lost their their health insurance as a result of COVID, lost their job, whatever. Take care of them. But the idea that there is a need for every American to get this level of gift from the federal government at the expense of our kids and grandkids is just almost physically repulsive to me. I mean, I want to throw up, Kevin. It's awful. And we're as much to blame as anything. The fact that the dang thing is popular, right? I mean, that there's a bipartisan support for this. No, there isn't bipartisan support in Congress, number one. Number two, yeah, you're running around saying, we'll give you free money. Do you want this or not? And sadly, more people are raising their hand yes than no.
Well, remember, there's $350 billion for states and localities. And Chuck Schumer bragged after the fact that we have now erased New York's debt or deficit, and Nancy Pelosi bragging we have now erased San Francisco's deficit, and they just gave it to them. And the bulk of the money goes to states and communities that shut down their economies. I want you to just imagine these incentives that are in this bill. Gave states and communities money who shut down their economies, shut down their businesses and their jobs. Therefore, there's no incentive for them to reopen their economy because they don't need the tax revenue from workers and from businesses and property taxes, because they just get it from the federal government. Secondly, there's no incentive for the businesses to open. There's no incentive for workers to go to work because they'd also enhanced and extended unemployment benefits again. There's no incentive for schools to open. We tried to put incentives with amendments that were voted down in a straight party line vote. Amendments that would require schools to reopen in order to get these large grants for them to help them to, quote, reopen. They wouldn't allow that, so there's no strings attached. In fact, of the $62.8 billion in the bill that we passed in December to go to schools, only $4 billion has been spent. And now we did another whatever it was, $100-some billion for schools. So a lot of this is just a slush fund. And in fact, even on the healthcare side, Scott, there are some pretty suspicious things. On the healthcare side, there was a lot of money for, not for testing, but for the vaccine to enhance the vaccine. I think $7.5 billion at CDC. There's over $6 billion for the supply chain of vaccines and therapeutics. But there's also, imagine this now, $47.8 billion for testing, contact tracing, and mitigation. Okay, so $7.5 billion for vaccine activities at CDC and $6 billion for the supply chain. But $48 billion for testing. Now, we have tests sitting on shelves all over this country. We have thousands of them right here in North Dakota. What's the point of testing if you're vaccinating? Right. You see what I'm saying? They're creating slush funds wherever they can create them. You know, for
we're cheering it on. And by we're, I mean I'm saying it's popular by a poll because it's free money. What have we become? It's unbelievable. Let me get Tom and James down at least to the question before the break here for Senator Kramer. Tom, you're next. Go ahead.
Well, I hope I can get this through quick enough. During 2009, with the big economic crisis, was put into place because of Bill Clinton's policies so people could get housing when they had no collateral, they had sometimes no jobs. Okay. So all of these loans were lumped together, and they were purchased by companies that bought lumped together loans, which were purchased by bigger companies.
I remember this movie well, Tom. Hang on, we'll let you finish it on the other side of the break so you get your question for Senator Kramer. But I need a refresher on that Ponzi scheme that was that mess. More after this. Don't go away. I'm not kidding you. I'm not lying to you right now. Use the promo code Scott, and you're going to get a deal on the MyPillow slippers. They have different sizes, colors. You know, they got the moccasins. They got the big foofy, comfy ones. MyPillow.com. Promo code Scott or call 800-506-9028. You can't make it up. Okay, Kevin, I'm thinking for Chris's, next birthday, maybe, anniversary. What do you think? Pillows and robes.
I'm sort of loving it. I've got so many MyPillows in my house and my apartment in Washington and my family. I don't know that I could, you get to wash them, as you know, so you don't need to throw them away.
Well, they got that lifetime warranty. It's forever. But now the slippers. The slippers. We can start loading up on.
Slippers. See, I don't have the robes either, but I do have the sheets. I have a couple of mattress toppers. And they all work great. But
we've sold so many robes, they only have men's in white left. They're restocking soon, but you still can get men's robes in white now, but that's it. We've overperformed on that, and it's amazing to see the outpouring of support for Mike Lindell, who, by the way, calls you his best friend in Washington, not just even the Congress, in all of Washington. And I know that doesn't scare you like it would probably scare some of your colleagues, but it's amazing what happens when you just fight for what you believe is right, isn't it? Sad, actually.
Well, you know what's so great, though, about being from North Dakota is when thousands of people come to Washington, D.C., and all my colleagues go hide in their offices. I get to go out in the lawn and talk to mine. and then we pray together. I don't know. It seems like a simple concept to me.
Yeah, no kidding. I'll never forget that. I mean, days before the world as we know it in Washington, D.C. Ended, you're out there with 100 folks from North Dakota on the mall with protests all around and having a robust discussion, of many of whom didn't agree with you about your planned vote on the 6th. So, think about that. That's the North Dakota way right there.
But amazing as that is, as obvious as it is to us, it's so amazing that the New York Times photographer that took the picture, they ran it 3 days in a row in the New York Times. I think because they thought we were nuts. That's why I think they ran.
Well, wasn't it of a group praying with you or something? Isn't that
it
what they
was,
put in?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't think that was a compliment from the New York Times. That was, look at these crazy people from North Dakota that pray with their senator. You know, that's what that was meant to do. But we'll take it.
I shouldn't laugh, but we need to every now and then, don't we?
Yeah, we do. Actually, you can't make it up. Okay, so Tom in Jamestown, you were starting to tell a story from the 90s. Go ahead and finish from there, and we'll get to the question next for Kevin.
Okay, well, I appreciate you bringing me back. Yeah, the point I'm trying to make is that during the financial crash, and I'm pretty sure that Senator Kramer is really aware of this, that all of these loans were passed up because all of the houses that were connected to the loans were increasing in value. And the reason why this scenario went on and on is because everybody that got the loans, even though they were bad loans, knew that They were coming out ahead as long as they could sell the houses and come out ahead. It's a very complicated thing. But the thing is, they knew the day was coming when these loans would no longer go up and they would start coming down in a hurry. All right, so what's that got to do with the deficit? Isn't it kind of the same way we keep piling on with the deficit, and everybody benefits, like you were talking earlier, everybody's popular thing, you know, to get all that money. Yeah. But isn't there a day of reckoning that may not be too far away? And is everybody playing the same stupid game, Democrat and Republican, on giving away all this money? I mean, isn't there, right now it's 105% of gross domestic product, but
yes, it
it's
is.
On its way up. There's nothing to show that it's going to go down unless you have massive tax increases and cuts in spending. You're never going to get the cuts in spending. But even that may not make a difference. So my question is, how can Democrats and Republicans keep doing this and be so doggone stupid and keep adding to our deficit?
Yeah, so Tom asked, first of all, Tom, thank you. Yeah, it's a great question, and you make a really good point leading up to it, and actually the question itself makes a really good point, because what we're doing is much like a Ponzi scheme. To answer your question directly, there are a couple of thoughts. How can they keep doing it? Well, first of all, we shouldn't be. That's the first thing. You raised the point of unless there are huge tax increases and spending cuts and or spending cuts. Well, as you know, raising taxes doesn't generate more revenue. Raising taxes, as the Laffer curve shows and as supply side economics shows, doesn't generate revenue. In fact, anything that hurts our economy is going to hurt our revenue. And that's why what you're describing and what we're doing right now by borrowing a bunch of money and then giving it away and creating perverse incentives for businesses not to open, for states not to open their businesses, for workers not to go to work. I mean, it's a cycle that is absolutely unsustainable. So at 105% of gross domestic product, our debt is already perilous. It, without a question, that's a bad place to be. One way to help, of course, is to grow our way out of it. And we're so far gone, I don't think we can completely grow our way out of it. By that, I mean the economy, Scott. Because the best way to deal with debt and deficit is to grow an economy, but you can't do it while you're growing the debt and deficit at the same time. So finding that balance. The other thing is we have to deal with, of course, with the mandatory side of the ledger. And I'm not going to go into a lot on that right now. I think Tom has a very good understanding of that. But there is a day coming. What I wonder, Tom, about what's going on is how did we get this far? And I think part of it is that since the last time that this happened, or anything remotely close to this happened, and especially, and I'm not just talking about the real estate bubble or the housing bubble, but back in the Depression and other economic challenges, the Federal Reserve has figured out some way in the printing of cash and the keeping of interest rates low to sort of expand our bad habits. That's what I worry about. Because eventually, and you're already seeing it, we like when oil's a little bit higher priced, right? We like when corn and wheat, other commodities are a little higher priced. We benefit as an economy from that. But that is called inflation. And the last time inflation really took off in a major way, of course, was when Jimmy Carter was the president. We had interest rates in the double digits. We had inflation in way into double digits. And that's the logical correction that is coming if we can't get our handle on it.
Well, you did. Am I still on?
You are, sir. Quickly, if you would. Right.
You did a great job describing it, Senator Cramer. What do we do about it? I mean, that's what everybody wants to know. Simpson Bowles was a commission put together by Barack Obama. Six Democrats, six Republicans. They recommended what I said earlier. You do have to raise taxes, and you do have to cut spending, because that's the only way you're going to get everybody on board, if you can get everybody on board. Everybody's got to pay a little bit to get this deficit down. What's wrong with that?
So what do we do about it? Was the question to Senator Cramer. I just want to add one question or one comment on this. Yep. If we don't do anything, let me inform the answer to the question this way by a texter saying, face it, deflation, inflation, hyperinflation, it's coming, tell the truth. That's the consequence of not answering Tom's bell there and what we do about it, correct?
So that's what I'm talking about with hyperinflation is the logical outcome of this, unless there's some voodoo I don't know about, but that's the logical outcome. So directly to Tom, I love that you raised Simpson Bowles because that was a pretty good effort. They came out with a good report, and then, of course, it was promptly dismissed because there's something in any bipartisan, equally divided report. There's always something for somebody not to like, and nowadays, it's all or nothing. Everybody negotiates from an all or nothing standpoint at the beginning and at the end. So there's a group of us, and I'm on the budget committee, and Mike Enzi, the former budget chairman who retired and now went home to Wyoming, really pushed this. We had a hearing that where two of the witnesses were Kent Conrad, a former Democratic budget committee chairman from North Dakota, well known as a budget hawk. Now he didn't like budget cuts as much as tax increases, but he was at least that he was committed to that, and he looked out for the budget. And the other was Senator Greg Judd, a former Republican chairman. They both served together. We had this very discussion that Tom's having right now. Mitt Romney, and I know there are plenty of listeners that don't like Mitt Romney, but Mitt Romney has sort of taken the lead on this particular topic in the forming of some sort of an outside group to do what Simpson Bowles did and provide the recommendations. But here's what I worry about, Tom. There's two things. One is any honest broker from the outside is going to come with ideas that either involve, well, that will involve both cutting of budgets and cutting of a raising of taxes. And as you know, there's a side for each of those, and people don't want to do one or the other of those things. The other thing is it really does sort of acquiesce our responsibility. Back to Tom's question to me, what are you going to do about it? What's the Congress going to do about it? I'm open to an outside commission looking at these things. I've talked to people like Rudy Boschwitz in Minnesota, former senator who's interested in the same kind of thing. But at the end of the day, Congress has to take the medicine. And this is why I love this show and why I love doing talk radio, because you guys, there's going to be some medicine that we're going to have to take. And it's going to involve the mandatory side of the ledger as well as the discretionary side of the ledger. And the mandatory side of the ledger is about 70% of our budget, and that includes Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, some farm programs that are, food stamps are mandatory spending. So we're going to have to be really honest and come up with some solutions, and I'm open to them.
Here's one from a listener. Texter says the only way I see a peaceful way out of this is a convention of the states. New amendments without going through Congress to limit government. Everyone should read Mark Levin's book, The Liberty Amendments. It's time for the people to bypass the corruption in Washington. We'll ask you what you think about that when we come back. Lindsey Graham, we got to get in. The water question. One more segment to go. Senator Kevin Cramer, Talk Radio Town Hall. Don't go away. Monday on the program, Christian Adams will join us, President General Counsel of the Public Interest Legal Foundation, to talk about H.R. 1. This is a lot of people worried. We have a lot of questions on this, so I'll just summarize related to H.R. 1 and concerns about, everything, right? I mean, everything. They're talking about how you stop something. Give me your best 30 seconds on what we do about the plans related to H.R. 1.
Well, we can't let it become law. We have to prevent it at all costs in the Senate, and I'm going to be talking to the North Dakota legislature here this afternoon, and I'm going to talk a little bit about H.R. 1, because remember, elections are run at the state level, and it's critical. What H.R. 1 does, and just in a nutshell, is, of course, it actually federalizes the elections, and it prohibits states from restricting illegal immigrants from voting. It requires registration. It's automatic registration for people. It prohibits states from having laws against or requiring voter ID. So you eliminate voter ID no matter what you think at the state level. It requires every state to allow ballot harvesting. That's when one person gathers the ballots of hundreds of other people and delivers it on their behalf. Isn't that a great idea? I mean, it's just insanity, Scott.
So somebody's asking, by the way, what time you're speaking on the House floor today. That's somewhat unusual. The member of the federal delegation speaking. I'm glad Kim Koppelman, Speaker of the House, and others have invited you to do so. What time is that happening today?
That's at 1 o'clock this afternoon, or 12:30. I forget which. It's right after lunch anyway. Lucky them. At least I don't get between them and lunch. But they'll have a full belly so they can sleep through it if they want. But it's right after lunch.
Texter says, "Come on, Scott. Lindsey Graham is all hat and no cattle. You know that. You've heard that before. I've listened for a long time for him to get in front of a microphone and tell us that this is going to happen or that's going to happen, to just be patient, just trust him, them. These guys are all the same. They never fight hard enough. They don't get anything done. I asked specifically some version of that question of Lindsey when you handed the phone to him last week. I want you to listen to his answer and talk a little bit about this. Here's that from last week in case you missed it. Roll it, Kevin. Senator Cramer and Senator Hoeven, and for that matter, every other Republican up here, John Thune, Tim Johnson, take grief daily from people that want them to fight more like Trump. Donald Trump's a friend of yours. You know the fight that he has put up. Is this an example this weekend of at least going to the wall fighting this bad stuff? Yeah. Are you fighting hard enough?
It is. Well, if we all fought like Trump, it'd be nobody alive on the planet. So what we got to do is fight hard for the conservative cause, and your senators, that part of the world, is not the problem, it's the solution. People work hard, they're good neighbors, it's tough to get through the winter. It's not like we don't want to help our fellow neighbor, but the Democratic Party is being run by the most liberal element in American politics, and President Trump did a hell of a job for 4 years. And mark my words, this bill is not going to play well. The more we talk about it, the more we expose it, the better chance we have of coming back in 2022. This is the Donald Trump party. He's the most important Republican in the party. We need to build a coalition to take back the House and the Senate. And this bill is a step toward us getting back in charge if we explain to the American people what they're doing with your money.
The part that stuck out for me from that comment is he was laughing, he was making light of it, but he talked about, if we all fought like Donald Trump, there'd be nobody left alive on the planet. I didn't know if he saw that as a compliment of how hard Trump fights or if he saw it as it sounded very derogatory to me. Am I reading that wrong?
Yeah, you are, I think. This is the first I heard it, so I don't, this is just off the cuff, but knowing Lindsey and knowing the president, I think he meant it as a compliment. But you're right. It was, as I think about it, it's sort of a funny illustration. But I think what he's saying is everyone should fight like Trump. And not that nobody should be left alive on the planet, but everyone should fight like Trump. And realizing, too, that he is putting this in the context of the COVID bill, that the $2 trillion monstrosity, the liberal wish list, the shopping list. And that made more sense the longer he talked.
Because that's this line that came from a listener, we want you guys fighting as hard as the third monkey on the ramp to Noah's Ark while it's raining,
right.
is humorous, but that is the level of fight people want. And I find myself in a position of saying, who would be better than John Hoeven and Kevin Cramer in the United States Senate from North Dakota? John Thune and Tim, Mike Rounds? No. Amy Klobuchar and the music teacher from Montana with the butch haircut? I don't think so. So on the other hand, I just hope, it's conveyed very clearly that people just, they've had it. They're done. They want fight.
Here's one of the things, though, Scott, that I think sometimes people confuse. Donald Trump was the president. He's the entire executive branch of the United States government. Congress is 535 people designed on purpose by our founders to
yes,
fight
and I hear
compromise.
You. And if and, we as Americans, as we as North Dakotans fight as hard, there'll be more Kevin Cramers, there'll be more people willing to go to the wall to do this, because that's up to us. That work comes back where we started today with Margie and Bismarck.